just this morning, but the series in general, in memory of Aaron Moshe ben Chanoch Hanoch, Feger Reisha, Bas Dov, Yosef ben Meir, and Zisa Bas Yitzhak Tzvia Cohen. And if Ellie, if you could just say a word or two. It's not a surprise.
I just wanted to say that how pleased I am to be able to sponsor the sport here. I think that you're going to find some academic interest and some practical use in them. It should be something that you all take back for your offices. It should be, as we cleared the brachos a couple of weeks ago, Zetorav and Isarifu Mu'ad. This is what I have to learn and take it back and make use of it.
Shkoyach, thank you very much. So this is the first of a four-part series, God willing. For those who have seen the flyer, you know that our second topic is supposed to be dental emergencies on Shabbos. The third one is braces, crowns, and mikvah. And then the last one is the kashrus of dental devices. I'm actually realizing that we should have probably altered the schedule a little bit. This is the kashrus of dental devices before Pesach. Because that was always, you always get some serious and some humorous questions related to that leading up. But in any case, the shiurim are recorded, the video goes on koshertube.com, the audio goes on yutorah.com, and you can't get credit if you just hear the recordings of the shiur. I don't think that works, but you can catch up on information that way. So if you happen to miss a shiur, that's a good way to catch up. As a general principle, whenever I give a halacha shiur, I begin with a disclaimer, which I'm going to use here as well, which is that I am not presenting practical halachic decisions within this. I'm going to be discussing issues of halacha, and I think you could probably extrapolate certain things from what I say, but for actual practical questions, I do want people to turn to their shul rabbis. And so I avoid going that step. In particular, actually, that's relevant in this topic because this is a very complex topic. And while I want to have questions and answers, I don't want it to just be a 45 minutes to an hour of monologue for my own sake as well as for your sake. Realistically, there's a lot of ground to cover. So you may ask a question in the middle, and I may say I want to come to that at the end. We'll see. There really is a lot to do here. Okay. One last word of introduction. I have to give a lot of credit to an article that actually came out fall 2011 in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society by Rabbi Dr. David J. Katz. He's a dentist in New York, New Jersey. He put together a lot of material on this topic. And it really helped me to develop my own understanding of it, and to structure what I'm doing today. It was also very helpful because I contacted him for some follow up on some things that he raised within the article, and he was helpful in that regard as well. I recommend the journal in general, and I recommend his article in particular. Okay, not everybody here is an oral surgeon. So I'm going to take a minute to just talk about what we're talking about, so to speak, to explain what we mean when we talk about bone grafts. So think of this as bone grafts for non-dentists. The indications for which bone grafts are used, as I understand it, and please, all the medical professionals, feel free to jump in and correct me. I'm used to that from my doctor, Shiram. But my understanding is that the basic indications are either for tooth loss or for jaw damage, and that the way that bone material may be used is to achieve what's called osseointegration, so that the implant becomes part of the site in the jaw. And that will it will take. And the materials that are used for this kind of procedure include synthetic possibilities, which don't have the halachic concerns that we're going to discuss now, but they also include using bone material. So there is a possibility for what's called autologous bone graft, in which you can take bone from the person who is receiving the implant and then process that bone and use it for the bone graft in the jaw. The problem with that includes, though, the fact that you now have an additional surgery involved, and it's also a rather painful procedure. So So people don't necessarily want to have their own bone used for this graft. So what tends to be used, because it's better, it's more effective in terms of integration, in terms of rejection concerns, what tends to be used is bone that comes from cadavers. You're talking about taking bone from somebody who has passed away and preparing the bone and then using that bone from a bone bank for a graft. And the technical term, I believe, is an allogenic bone graft. Am I good so far in terms of what we're talking about? Is that a good enough decision description for us to work with? If not, you can say so. The basic method of preparing the bone is important. They remove soft tissue first from the material, sterilize the bone through chemicals, crush the bone to a size of 250 to 750 micrometers, and then there's an acid bath that's used for the bone for demineralization, and then you have your product that may actually be used in the graft. Most bone banks, from what I've read, they mix together bone from different sources. So when someone gets bone material, they're not actually getting bone from one particular body, they're getting it from multiple bodies, and that's actually good for halachic purposes, for the issue that we're going to discuss. So in terms of our discussion, I'm going to stipulate at the outset that I'm not talking about a life and death case, because what I want to address is the question of whether it's permissible to use this material and to address certain questions that come up for Kohanim. I don't want to get into a case of life and death because that sort of trumps all the concerns that we're going to raise, and it's very easy. Rabbi, I need to save somebody's life with this. I'm not sure I can come up with a life and death situation anyway. But I need to save someone's life with this. The answer is okay, go ahead and do it, and it's a very short shear. What I want to talk about is replacing a tooth for somebody who needs the tooth for cosmetic purposes, for someone who needs it in order to be able to eat. Maybe there are pain issues involved. And as I said before, I want to shift the discussion of, well, how severe is this in the eyes of Jewish law, to the second one, where we talk about dental emergencies on Shabbos, and focus more on the question of what the permissibility is of using material from a cadaver as one piece of this, and then as a second piece of this, issues of what's called in Hebrew tumah, of impurity, if either the patient or the oral surgeon is a Kohen. And I'll explain that as we go through it. I have four different cases that I want to address. The first case that I'd like to look at is very basic and straightforward. Jonathan, age 35, is Jewish. He has some kind of damage to his teeth, and he needs to have an implant. And is he allowed to receive an allogenic bone graft? The issue at hand is benefit from a cadaver. So I'll put the question to you. What do you think the issues would be in dealing with this? If you looked at the sources ahead, you're disqualified. What do you think the issues are when we're dealing with this attempt to graft bone into a person's jaw? Not a Kohen. No Kohen issues involved. Kavod hameis, honor for the person who passed away, right? We're now taking a piece of this person's body, and given willingly, of course, but we're taking a piece of the person's body, and instead of burying it, we are implanting it in somebody's jaw. So that's one potential issue.
Is Jewish or not Jewish?
Is the person who is the source of this, is this person Jewish or not Jewish? That's a great question we're going to have to come back to, because there are certain aspects that change depending on whether you're dealing with a Jew or someone who is not Jewish. Pooled bone. So in other words, let's say, to build on the point of saying that there is a difference between how I'm going to handle Jewish and non-Jewish, so what if there is bone from a Jew in there, but it's going to be a small percentage of the mixture? It's interesting because you see responsa on this issue of use of bone beyond the bone graft discussion, because it comes up in other areas of Jewish law. The answers may differ depending on whether the person responding is in Israel, where the assumption is the majority of the bone is coming from a Jew, or they're outside of Israel, in which case it's more likely that it's coming from someone who is not Jewish. So these are some of the issues. Let's get into the case. So we do have precedent in discussions of Jewish law regarding cornea transplants and other transplants to discuss the issue of using pieces of a person's body. Number one, and most important perhaps, we believe in the dignity of the human body. This has nothing to do with Jew or non-Jew. The core concept, we believe that the human body must be treated with respect on many levels. The Gemara in Menachos, it's Chav Tes Amud Beis 29b, talks about the horror that was expressed by Moshe Rabbeinu, who when he had a vision of how Rabbi Akiva's body was going to be treated by the Romans after Rabbi Akiva had already died. The body retains its status because of its involvement in mitzvot when the person was alive. There's also an element of honor to God in the way we treat the body. The Torah talks about the unfortunate case in which someone receives capital punishment in a Jewish court and how we have to have respect for the body, even though this, in order to get capital punishment, you have to do something really, really bad and with great intent. You have to receive a warning. If you do this, this is going to be your penalty. And then you have to say, I know, and I'm doing it on that condition, and you go out and carry out this terrible crime. And there are witnesses, and it's a hard thing to do, to give somebody capital punishment in Jewish law. It also hasn't existed for a while. But it's a hard thing to do, such that I might have expected that you would actually want to treat the body with disrespect. You would want to say, well, this person did something so terrible. Nonetheless, we're told you have to bury that person on the same day. There's a matter of respect to God who created this person in the first place. We are taught that when a person is alive, there's a mitzvah of bal tishaktu. You're not allowed to treat your body in a repellent way. A person is not allowed to do things that degrade the body while he's alive. There's the issue also of honor for the living in terms of the way that you handle the deceased. Because to a certain extent, if we treat a human body with disrespect, that says something about the way we treat human beings in general. And therefore, we're told to treat the body with respect. The Chasam Sofer of Moshe Sofer wrote, I haven't gotten into the sources on the sheets yet, Rav Moshe Sofer wrote that the requirement of burial teaches us that the sanctity of the body remains after a person dies. There's even a concept that the soul is pained by what's done to the body, even after death. We have a passage in the book of Iyov that describes the person's soul mourning for the body as the body deteriorates. There's a bit of debate within Jewish sources as to the awareness of the soul after a person passes on. How much is the soul aware of what's going on with the body? But all of this issue of the dignity of the human body, leads to three technical problems. Technical problem number one is what's called nivul hamet, disgracing the body. And here, if you take a look at your sheets, we get into the sources that I brought. You see at the top of the sheet, I gave you the reference to the article I mentioned from the RJJ Journal, the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. But in source number one, we get a very interesting story in its own right. It comes up in discussions of autopsy. I'll ask people to share. I made 20 copies, but I think we have a few more people than that. The Talmud has the following story. Maaseh b'bnei brak b'echad shemachar b'nichsei aviv umeis. A person had sold off family assets that had been his father's. And then he died. Ubau b'nei mishpacha ve'ir aru lomar katan haya b'sh'az misa. And then family members objected after he died and said he was actually a minor. He had sold off assets that he had inherited from his father. And the challenge was he doesn't deserve to be able to sell off those assets because he was actually a minor at the time of death, and then certainly at the time of the sale he had been a minor. If those who are coming in could sit next to somebody who has sheets, that would probably be helpful. Vishalu as Rabbi Akiva mahu lebodko. So they asked Rabbi Akiva, are we allowed to exhume the body in order to see whether we can determine that he was in fact mature at the time of death, or that he was not mature at the time of death? That was the question put to Rabbi Akiva. And Omar Lahem, Rabbi Akiva replied to them with two points. Number one, he said, "Iatem rashoim lenavlo. You are not permitted to degrade his body. You're exhuming him just in order to have financial gain. You want to reverse the sales that he did. And by the way, he says, we don't have the technology to properly determine at this point that he was in fact an adult at the time of death. At this point, any physical signs on the body have been degraded, and therefore you wouldn't be able to gain anything by this in any case. So Rabbi Akiva's statement to them, his first point was, you're degrading the body. We're not going to exhume him for the sake of his family's wealth. That's not acceptable. So our first concern when dealing with material from a cadaver is this degrading to the body? Our second concern is that we are delaying burial. As you can see in source number 2, the Rambam, Maimonides, talks about a case in which a person says, don't bury me. And we're told here, im tziva shalo yikaver, ein shom in lo. If a person instructs, don't bury him, we don't listen to him. Shakavura mitzvah, burial is a mitzvah. Shenemar ki kavor sikparenu, the Torah says, you shall surely bury him. Now that raises certain questions. What if somebody has a relative who instructs that he should be cremated? Those are really interesting discussions, but beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now. The point for this is that my mitzvah of burying somebody is independent of his personal wishes. And therefore, even if you'll tell me, well, he willed his body to the bone bank, and therefore he doesn't want to be buried, the answer may be, yeah, but I'm obligated to bury him anyway. And then a third concern that comes up. We're just listing the concerns. Then we have to get to the mitigating factors. But the third concern that comes up is that we have a general prohibition against benefiting from the dead, taking physical benefit from those who have passed away. If you take a look at source number 3, you find the Talmudic discussion that leads to that. It talks about a textual link between two passages in the Torah and says that one, in fact, is not permitted to benefit from a corpse. There is some debate as to whether this should really be viewed as biblical or as rabbinic. And that's an important point that I'm going to stress throughout this discussion, because if we're dealing with biblical law, then that has a certain level of stringency to it. If we're dealing with rabbinic law, then the level of stringency is somewhat reduced. And in the event of a person being in pain or a person suffering from disease, we may be willing to override a rabbinic concern in order to treat the patient. So therefore, it matters when we say this may in fact be rabbinic. So those are our three concerns for our patient that we talked about in our first case. This patient who needs a bone graft, and we want to give him the allogenic graft. We want to give him a graft from another human being via the bone bank. We have one concern is disgracing the body of this donor. Our second concern is delay of burial. And then the third concern is that one may not be allowed to benefit from a corpse. So on the flip side, we're dealing with indications of someone who's missing a tooth, may not be able to eat, may be experiencing pain. Yeah, in a psychological sense, in an emotional sense, because of the lack of a tooth, may even be dealing with pain in a physical sense. So let's look at what the mitigating factors are for each of these three concerns. First, the issue of degrading the body, whether this is called treating the body in a degrading way. So if you take a look at source number 4, you find the writing of Rabbi Moshe Isserles in the beginning of the 16th century. It's part of the code of Jewish law and accepted as law, certainly by Ashkenazi Jews, possibly by Sephardim as well. He talks about not a case of grafting bone, but he talks about treating a body in a way that one might think of as degrading. If a person instructs those who survive him, he says, I would like my body to be transported. He's living in Toronto, and he says he'd like to be buried in Montreal. So he says, I want my body to be transported, more commonly burial in Israel. So if someone leaves such an instruction, so he says he'd like to be buried at home on his own property instead of being taken to the cemetery, and some might consider that disrespectful. Shom in lo, we listen to him. A person is able to forgive what might be considered disrespectful treatment of his body. So if a person says he's willing to have his body used for this purpose, then it's no longer considered to be a problem of disrespect. We go even further with it. Umuter liten sid alav kedei la'akel habasar maher lo'alicho l'makom asher tziva. There was a practice going back a couple of thousand years of actually moving a body, exhuming a body as part of routine. They would bury the body in the grave. After the flesh had decayed, you were just left with bones. They would put the bones in an ossuary, in a box where you had the bones of the family. You probably heard about the case a couple of years ago where they discovered what they thought was the bones of a fellow by the name of James in the family ossuary. That's another discussion for a very different class. But they would, in some cases, speed up the deterioration of the flesh by applying lime on the flesh. Now, if you ask me to define disgraceful activities for a body, you know, that would come to mind. Nonetheless, he's willing to accept it because it's for his own good, for the good of the persons that will be able to transfer the bones to their ultimate place of rest. So we have this idea that disgrace of the body might well be forgiven. That's number one. And number two, looking at the lime part in the second half, not everything that we think of as disgrace is necessarily considered disgrace. And I bring you a case in source number 5. I'm not going to go into it at length. We're already 20 minutes in. But I think it's an important thing to know about. There's a discussion about exhuming a body for the sake of gaining certain evidence so that a widow would be able to remarry. She could be identified as a widow. In other words, we want to determine that a man died so that his widow will be able to remarry. We need to exhume the body in order to be able to gain that evidence. We are willing to do so. We're willing to exhume the body in order for her to be able to be freed from an aguna situation, a situation in which she can't marry. But exhuming a body is not respectful. That's normally true, but this is not called disrespect, where it's for the sake of freeing her from this marriage to her deceased husband so that she's going to be able to remarry. So there are justifications in terms of our goal as well as in terms of the person forgiving this. There was a question.
Yes, just ask a bit.
Yes, please.
You try by saying someone says nothing, they don't want to bury you, you're not listening to them. Now you're equating the allowance to delay someone's burial, and so it instructs us, and therefore we're allowed to degrade the body somewhat. But ultimately, in that reference, he's going to be buried. In our case, the grass has never been buried if we use it for some other purpose.
Correct. So I have to make sure to distinguish between two categories. One is the issue of disgrace of the body, and the other is delay of burial. Forgiveness here, for the person to say, I'm okay with this, that takes care of the disgrace issue. We haven't yet dealt with the delay of burial issue in terms of any mitigating factors, but you're right. And that's the next point, is the delay of burial. For him to say, I'm okay not being buried, isn't going to work for us. For him to say, I'm okay with you doing something that people consider disgraceful to my body, that does work. So what we've done is, we've mitigated our first concern. We've mitigated the concern for disgrace to the body, but now we have to move to the question of delaying burial. So one potential mitigating factor is that the mitzvah of burial might be considered a rabbinic mitzvah. The language in the Talmudic mitzvah of burial is unclear, because when the Talmud records it, it says, remez, there's a hint, to burial from this pasuk of Ki Kavor Sikbarenu. Let me state it a little bit differently. I mentioned before, there is a biblical verse of you shall surely bury. That's presented in the Torah in the context of dealing with capital punishment, as I discussed then. It is clear that there is a biblical mitzvah of burying somebody who was executed by a court. It is not clear that we extrapolate from there to all burial. That may just be a biblical mitzvah of bury the person who was executed by a court. There may not be a biblical mitzvah of burying everybody else. That might actually be rabbinic extrapolation. Yes?
So how come Abraham was so keen on burying Sarah?
Right.
Right.
The first example of burial that we are familiar with certainly is Abraham burying Sarah, but that may not mean that it's actually a biblical obligation. That may just mean Abraham was doing something respectful for his wife Sarah, in the same way that Abraham gives a eulogy, we're told, right? It says, L'spod l'Sarah, he gives her a eulogy. That doesn't necessarily turn eulogy into a biblical mitzvah either. It's just something that's appropriate to do.
Yeah, well,
Right, Yaakov buries. Oh, we have numerous cases. Once you get started, we have numerous cases of burial in the Torah, right? Aharon is buried, God buries Moshe. We find the verb vayikbor, and he buried, comes up quite often.
Okay,
sorry? All true.
So it's something to be concerned about.
Yes. I'm not in any way meaning to diminish the importance of burial by saying it would be rabbinic, but take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 6, where the Rambam writes, Maimonides writes, Mitzvah aseh shal divrayim levakir cholim. The Rambam, in this 14th chapter in the Laws of Mourning, deals with a variety of chesed activities, good things that we do for each other. And he says it's a mitzvah aseh shel divrehem. That means it's a rabbinic mitzvah. Levaker cholim, to visit the sick, to examine the sick. Ulis aseh b'chol tzerchei akavura, to be involved in all burial needs. Af al pi shekol mitzvos elu midivrehem. He concludes the thought by saying that these are all rabbinic mitzvot. Harein b'chol v'yahavta l'reacha kamocha. You should know they're all included in love your neighbor as yourself. We are taught to treat others with respect and with care, and therefore there's a mitzvah of burial, but he seems to think it's rabbinic. On the other hand, the Tur, an early code of Jewish law, expresses it as biblical in source number 7. If you see source number 7, Rabbi Yochanan, they're quoting from the Talmud there, Rabbi Yochanan says, Minayin lekvura min haTorah, what's the source for burial from the Torah? Perish etzarech lekovro bekarka, meaning that one must bury in earth. Below yitenu ba'aron v'yanichenu kach, not just leave the body in a box somewhere. Talmud lomar ki kavor sikvarenu, you shall surely bury. So the Torah says it's biblical. Yes.
But what about the Kohen Gadol? What's allowed to get
done,
except for one exception?
Right, the mitzvah. So he would not be able to perform the. He would not be able to perform the mitzvah.
No, he's allowed to. He's the only one.
Oh, you mean in the Mitzvah case?
Yes,
then he is.
Yes.
Right.
I see what you're asking.
Right. So Tommy asks a very interesting question. If the Mitzvah is only rabbinic, how is it that we say that a Kohen, and especially the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, is allowed to override his biblical prohibition against becoming impure in order to take care of burial of a body? If burial is only rabbinic, why does it override? It's a good question. I'm going to use the email to follow up on it. Because it's not going to fit in the scope of what we're going to discuss right now, but it's a good question for me to come back to.
Who would the obligation be on? It can't be on every person to bury every single body.
Why not?
Well, if it was up, then it just makes more sense to say there's an obligation that the body be buried rather than there's an obligation each individual to bury
so
the body.
So it's an interesting question. The question that's asked is, does that really mean that everybody is obligated to bury any given mace, any given body, so that when I get the material from the bone bank, it's my obligation to worry about this person's burial? And the answer is that you're right. The first obligation is family. That's the initial obligation. However, the Mace Mitzvah case that Tommy just referenced, if I find a body which has not been buried, it absolutely is incumbent upon me to do the burial. That will be my obligation. That's similar to other mitzvahs of chesed in general. For tzedakah, we say family is supposed to help first, and then the local area people are supposed to help first, but ultimately, if I see somebody in need, it's my obligation to take care of that need. So that's not just a burial point, that's true in general. So there is the possible argument that the mitzvah of burial is rabbinic. However, the greater leniency seems to come in from the size of the bone that's actually being used. Size may matter. If you take a look on the second side in source number 8, and realizing that there are three sides, you know we have three sheets. So there's a lot we have to get to still. The source number 8. The Shulchan Aruch writes, I'm going to start summing up sources rather than presenting them from inside, but you can see them there and you can read along. The Shulchan Aruch talks about the obligation to bury a mace mitzvah, a body that I encounter that has no one to bury it. And it seems to say that obligation is even if there's just one body part. So if I find a body and I bury the body, I'm a kohen. Now, I'm not supposed to become impure. I'm not supposed to become involved with the dead. However, it needs someone to bury it. I take care of the burial. And then I find another part that hadn't been buried. I'm supposed to go back and bury that other part, becoming impure all over again. So there seems to be a mitzvah of burial even on individual parts, even if they are small. There's more to say about that, but that seems fairly clear. However, there are sources that disagree and say if it's smaller than an olive-sized amount, there may be no mitzvah of burial. Now, how large is an olive is actually a really good question. It depends whose olive you're talking about. But you're talking about something of significant size already. I've seen an estimate of 2.5 cubic centimeters as one estimate of an olive-sized amount. The size may matter according to some, because the question is, what triggers the obligation to bury? Rabbi Meshulam Roth, writing in Israel in the 50s, in source number 9, says the obligation is linked in the Torah. The obligation to bury is linked to the issue of impurity. And therefore, if you have something that is not large enough to communicate impurity, and we're going to come back to what that is, then there may be no obligation to bury it. And therefore, the argument could be made that the bone material may not be subject to the obligation to bury. This is also seen in the Tosafos Yom Tov in the 10th parak in Shabbos, and several other sources that are just beyond the scope of the time frame that we have for this discussion. But the argument could be that since it's very small, I'm not obligated to bury it. And then there's a third argument, which I find fascinating. And everybody who has heard this argument has found it fascinating, and it keeps getting quoted in the literature. It wasn't made all that long ago. It was just a few decades ago. But this argument comes from Rabbi Yisrael Unterman in his work Shevet Miyahuda, and I brought it in source number 10. Rabbi Unterman argues that when the bone is inserted into the body and it integrates into the body, it's no longer dead. What you've accomplished is actually, in a sense, tchiyas hametim, the resurrection of the dead. You have resurrected the bone by restoring it to life. And therefore, he argues, there is no further obligation of burial. It's live bone. That's the argument that he presents. It's a fascinating argument. No? It changes the way you look at transplant altogether. So that's a third argument here. Roshama Zalman Orbach in Israel was not so pleased with that. He wrote to the Nishmas Avram, to Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham, that since there's a mitzvah of burial, by what right do you act to nullify that mitzvah by restoring it to life? Effectively, what you've done is you've canceled a mitzvah. Also, Rav Herschel Schachter notes, this is a quote I have from that article I referenced, that the resurrection of this tissue isn't accomplished until the tissue is incorporated into the body and actually does start to function. Until then, you really are delaying burial. Nonetheless, it's an interesting point that that this isn't dead material anymore. A fourth reason for leniency, and last within this category, is from Rabbi Meir Steinberg, writing in the journal called Noam, it's source number 11. He suggests that you are burying the body. This person who donated the bone, the rest of the body was buried. It's not that the rest of the body was not buried. He's actually not dealing with a bone case. He's dealing with a cornea transplant case. So he says, you took out the cornea, but you buried everything else, including the rest of the eye. And therefore, he argues that that's considered sufficient. You've done burial even if the cornea did not get buried. Rabbi Dr. Katz, actually, in his article, suggests something else, which he quoted in the name of the Rabbi Steinberg, who I just mentioned. I didn't see it in Rabbi Steinberg's words, but it's worth noting, which is that the person who receives the transplant ultimately one day is also going to die. And at that point, his body is going to be buried. So there is a burial eventually, unless you hypothesize, you know, a series of transplants down the line. There is theoretically that possibility. But we have four reasons to potentially be lenient in a case of need for this allogenic bone graft, despite the reasons for burial. Number one, the mitzvah of burial may be rabbinic. Number two, it's a very small quantity that's being used, perhaps not even large enough to communicate impurity. Number three, it comes back to life in the recipient. And number four, the body is buried. It's just this small amount that's not being buried. Michael. So, as I understand it, I'll ask the oral surgeons present to actually discuss this more than I can, but the reason why we use bone from a human being is because it integrates well and actually will regrow, will begin to grow in. That's osseointegration. Is that correct?
Yeah, not really.
The bone does not come back to life. Okay. Right. You will end up creating your own.
If you use a synthetic type of bone,
yeah.
So that bone, well, it depends. So synthetic bones also get turned over, but in reality, the bone graft that we use, it doesn't have any cells because it's irradiated or whatnot to it. So it has no cells. Its purpose is to act as a scaffold for the site so the site doesn't collapse,
yeah.
And to stimulate your own bone to create new cells to create your own new bone. That's the purpose. It's actually turned over.
So the sole purpose of using human bone, as opposed to others, is the rejection issue?
No.
So then what's the value of using the human bone?
To use human bone is just to, because it stimulates your bone quicker for quicker turnover.
So it's stimulating your bone. That's
there's
the,
no
that's
rejection. So even if you use bovine bone, so that's bone from a cow or bone from a pig, there's no rejection because there's no cells in it. There's no actual cells in this bone. It's just a scaffold,
mm-hmm.
And the beauty of human bone is that it will stimulate your bone to grow as well.
So it's it's stimulating your bone to grow, but it's
right.
Not itself growing.
Yeah.
Right, so the cornea is different. So
the cornea is different.
So then the question becomes, why is this being quoted, because I've seen it quoted in the literature regarding bone. The answer may be that it's our definition of life that's really at stake. In other words, is it defined as living because it can itself reproduce or function in some system, or is it enough that it's part of a living system and stimulating the growth of the cell? That may be why there would be this argument would come up. It's an interesting point. Thank you for clarifying that for me. Yes. Right, gizomoclif items. Right, the answer is not necessarily. In brief, not necessarily. There's more we could say about it. Some of it's going to come up in the impurity discussion, which I want to get to. So I'll hold off on that for now. Yes.
Yeah. Even though the bone has not been buried yet, some person is obligated until it's buried, and given the fact that it might be all of size or more to begin with, and these obligations stand until. But you did mention the bone was treated. So because of something that may be like hair or nail, which may not transfer too much, maybe the possibility the bone is no longer considered bone because it's so well treated,
right.
It's acid washed, proteins removed, collagen removed.
Right, so I'm going to come back to that in the impurity discussion. We'll get there, God willing. The third issue that we brought as a problem is the issue of benefit from a dead body. Am I allowed even to benefit from a corpse? So there are a few mitigating factors that are suggested here. One, the Chasam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, seems to suggest that the prohibition against benefiting from a dead body only applies if there is impurity. And therefore, if we can determine in fact that it's small enough that there is no impurity, then the prohibition against benefiting would no longer be relevant. That's number one. Number two, our second mitigating factor is that this benefit may be considered unusual. It's an unusual form of benefit. This is not normally what is thought of in terms of benefiting from something, having it implanted in one's body. The Radvaz, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, I should say, in source number 12, dealt with this issue in his day, and his day is 500 years ago. They were taking flesh from mummies and using flesh from mummified bodies as some kind of medicinal thing. I don't know what they were treating with it. But he wanted to know, why are people able to do this? Because apparently Jews were doing it as well. He wanted to know, why isn't this a prohibited form of benefit? You're benefiting from a dead body. And he suggests, I brought you a piece of it in source number 12, that this is not normal benefits. That's not the normal form of benefiting. However, most authorities disagree, led by the Mishnah Lamelech, Rabbi Yehuda Rosanus in source 13, commenting on Maimonides. He says, where the Torah specifies a particular act as being prohibited, if the Torah says don't eat something, then other forms of use are permitted. If, however, the Torah simply says don't benefit, and that's our assumption regarding the corpse, that it's a blanket prohibition against benefit, then all forms of benefit are prohibited. And this is brought by Rabbi Akiva Eger, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and others. You can't argue that this is not a normal form of benefit in this case. That argument would not work. There is, though, and this goes back to a question that was raised before, the question of whether this applies for Jew and non-Jew alike. The prohibition against benefiting from the body. The obligation to respect the body is across the board. That's not an issue. We are all created in the image of God. That's not the question. However, the technical prohibition of you are not permitted to benefit from a body may in fact be limited to Jews. So that as long as you treated the body of someone who wasn't Jewish, as long as you treated it with the utmost respect that had permission and so on, all the requirements that we stipulated before, then the argument goes, you would be allowed to benefit from the body. If you take a look at source number 14, you find that the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, said no. The Shulchan Aruch writes regarding benefit even from the shrouds in which a body is buried, that you can't benefit from it, whether the body was a Jew or a non-Jew is irrelevant. Hold on for 1 minute, please. That's the position of the Shulchan Aruch, but this argument does indeed exist. In a particularly graphic note that's brought in source 15, they discuss why human skin is considered to be tameh, is considered to be impure. And you see there, the Talmud says that the rabbis declared it to be impure as a rabbinic decree, lest a person take his parent's skin and turn it into a hanging, like a wall hanging. I don't know what to say. That's the consideration that's mentioned there in the Gemara, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden comments on that, and he says this prohibition is going to apply to any human being. You can't do that to any human being, Jew or non-Jew. You can't do that. And therefore, the sense of many authorities is that we would not distinguish between Jew and non-Jew. I wouldn't be allowed to benefit from anyone. But there is this possible view that may be dependent on in a case of need, that maybe if the donor willingly gave this and stipulated this is what I want it to be used for, suspending therefore the issue of respect for the body, and if there's no obligation for burial, then you could say I'm allowed to benefit from it because it's from someone who is not Jewish. I didn't really give enough time to the side that says that you are allowed to benefit from it. It's based on a Rishalmi and Shabbat and a Gemara and Avodah Zarah. I'm scrambling for time looking at this and realizing we're already more than 40 minutes in. That's my problem with it.
Presuming a body, is that a matter of report to help in the guna? Is that a matter of dignity or benefiting the body?
Dignity. One of the points that mitigates when you're dealing with benefit from a body is, and we're going to come back to this actually in the next case. Hold off on that. I'm going to come back to it in the next case. The upshot of what we've said so far, when we ask the question of whether the Jewish patient is allowed to receive this graft, is that while there are three concerns, honor of the body, obligation to bury, and benefit from the body, there are mitigating factors for each which could be brought into play, particularly if the quantity used is not sufficient to communicate impurity and therefore may not trigger the obligation to bury and may not trigger the concern for inappropriate benefit. The second case that I wanted to address, which is an outgrowth really of the first, is the issue of a Jewish oral surgeon doing the graft for a non-Jewish patient. Let's say the patient has no issue. The patient isn't operating under Jewish law. But the surgeon is. Is the surgeon allowed to do this? So ordinarily I would stop and ask you what you think the issues are, but in the interest of time, I'm going to skip that. It's not because I don't want to know what you think. It's because, you know, we got to get through it. So number one, there is a prohibition against helping someone who isn't Jewish to sin. Okay? I am not supposed to enable someone to do something wrong. Whether that person is Jewish or non-Jewish is irrelevant. I brought you source number 17. There's a prohibition against anybody, Jew or non-Jew, taking something from an animal while it is still alive and then eating that later. You have to make sure the animal is dead before you're going to take the meat from it. So a Jew is not allowed to give that sort of meat to someone who isn't Jewish and say, well, why do I care? It's his problem. You can't do that. You can't lead somebody to sin. However, it is not at all clear that a non-Jew is obligated in the mitzvah of burial. It's not at all clear that the non-Jew is not allowed to benefit from a corpse. That's not in what we usually list as the Noahide laws. So therefore, there's no problem of enabling him to sin. It's not a sin for him. However, going back to Dr. Sutton's question, the question would be, am I benefiting by carrying out the surgery since I'm going to be paid for the surgery? The general rule is that indirect benefit is permitted. Rutzi Pesach Frank dealt with this question regarding autopsy, and the question of whether if you're involved in a dissection of a cadaver or if you're involved in an autopsy, are you benefiting? And Rutzi Pesach Frank felt, no, that's indirect benefit. You benefit from looking at it. That's not called benefit for you. Of course, the recipient of the graft is benefiting, but your benefit is that you're paid for the job. And that may not be prohibited under this indirect benefit category. However, that's not so clear-cut. And the reason it's not so clear-cut is because the rule is when I'm not allowed to benefit from something, that means I'm not allowed to sell it. And could the argument be made that the surgeon here essentially is selling the material, he's also selling the implantation of the material, to the patient? You are being paid for the service of using this material. Therefore, I think that it is solid to argue, in the event that the bone graft is prohibited for a Jewish patient because of benefiting from the body, then it also will be prohibited for the Jewish oral surgeon to do it, even for a non-Jewish patient. That would not be any more permissible. On the other hand, flip it around, if it's permitted for a Jewish patient, if we're not concerned about benefit from the body, then it's also going to be permitted for the Jewish oral surgeon to engage in this procedure for a non-Jewish patient. It all hinges on the question of whether benefit from the body really is prohibited or not. You follow? Is that clear? Okay. That concludes the first two of our cases and the general issue. We still have a separate issue. The separate issue is, what about this whole impurity thing that I referenced a couple of times, and how does that impact on either a recipient or a surgeon who is a Kohen? The Torah teaches us that the corpse of a human being transmits impurity, transmits it in at least three different ways that matter for us. Number one, on contact. Number two, if you carry the body, even without being in physical contact with it, meaning you're wearing a rubber glove or there's something in between you and the material. And number three, based on ohel, by being in a shared space with it. Those are the three ways in which a body might communicate impurity. So is this an issue then for a Kohen surgeon or for a Kohen patient? So, first of all, is there any problem whatsoever with a Kohen becoming impure nowadays when, frankly, everybody is impure? In the times of a Beis HaMikdash, when you have a temple, you have a ritual for eliminating impurity. However, that's not germane today. We don't have that ritual of the Para Aduma. That doesn't exist nowadays. Everybody has become impure at some point or another. The classic question that was asked when I was growing up in New York was, is a Kohen allowed to go into Giant Stadium since Jimmy Hoffa is supposed to have been buried under the end zone? That's not so funny for Jimmy Hoffa, you know. But the question is this really an issue at all? So we had a long discussion about this last year in one of the CME Shiurim for Doctors, where we talked about the issue of a doctor being a Kohen. So just to digest the debate very quickly, I brought you sources number 21, number 22. The position of the Rambam of Maimonides is indeed that even somebody who is already impure is not allowed to become impure intentionally again. It's mosif tuma al tuma, so adding impurity. A Kohen is not allowed to enter a cemetery even though he's already impure anyway, barring the cases of going in for a relative. That's not the point right now. Whereas the Ravid, commenting on the Rambam, disagreed and said, depending on how I interpret source number 22, either that it's biblically permitted or that it's rabbinically permitted, either that it's entirely permitted or that it's just biblically permitted but rabbinically prohibited for a Kohen to become Tamei. So the takeaway from this is that there is some debate as to whether a Kohen may become impure nowadays. We generally follow the Rambam on this, that a Kohen is not allowed to become impure knowingly today, even though he's already impure anyway, just because everybody comes in contact with this at some point. Background number two. We need to know the kinds of impurity involved and the quantities involved. And here I gave you a table on the sheet in order to help. Clearly, this item, this bone material, started out as bone. And therefore, it was in the top row on your table. A barley kernel size amount, which is given in the article I cited, Rabbi Dr. Katz's article, as a third of a centimeter by 1 centimeter, like that plate covered with powder, that would be already the volume of a barley kernel. Even that is already sufficient to communicate impurity if one touches it, or if one carries it. By being in a shared space with it, one would only become impure if they had a huge amount of it. 6 egg volumes of it, possibly even 12 egg volumes of it. A large amount, larger, I think, than you generally keep in the office, based on what I've heard. This last quantity, right? Is that correct? I mean, that's more than people usually would keep in the office. Sorry? 6 eggs, 12 eggs. I mean, that sounds like more than what I'm used to hearing, from people in this. However, this may not be viewed as bone. We may not look at this as bone. We might look at this as crushed bone and therefore having a different category altogether. It started out as bone, but then it was indeed crushed. And if you take a look at source number 25, I'm skipping number 24 where he got it from, but the Rambam writes, Etzem kisa'ora shenechlak lishnayim mitame b'masa. If you have a barley kernel's quantity of bone, but it's split into two parts, it still communicates impurity. It contaminates when carried. V'chein rova atzamos meis echad shnidaktiku ve'ein b'chol echad mehem etzem kisa'ora mitamin ba'ohel. A quarter kav, which is that 6 egg volume, of crushed bone from one body, in which no piece of bone is the size of a barley kernel, only communicates impurity via shared space. Crushed bone is viewed as different from regular bone, and therefore, it will not communicate impurity on contact. That's number one. So touching it will not be a problem. Number two, carrying it will still communicate impurity potentially, and sharing space with it may communicate impurity as well. There's a third type of material that this may become, material called rakav. I got a battery low on my recording. Anybody have a AAA battery? If not, then I'll just take it off of the video. No? Okay. So much for that. On the rakav, this third category that I'm talking about, if a body deteriorates, as bodies eventually do, the material of the body becomes something known as rakav, decayed material. If you take a look at source number 26, Rabbi Yossi says that if you have an olive-sized amount of flesh from a body and it cannot be rehydrated, at that point it only contaminates as something called rakav. Rakav has a much more lenient status. As you see on the table, it's the third row in the table, you would require like 2 handfuls of the material in order for it to communicate impurity. It's a much more lenient, I should say, type of impurity involved. So that's important to realize. We may not be dealing with as great a concern. So what are our mitigating factors here? How do we deal with this? So number one, we said at the outset, again, our concern is to provide medical benefit for the patient, and that may override certain considerations, particularly if we're alleviating pain with this. So, first of all, we may be able to be lenient because we could argue, based on the Ravid, that the Kohen involved is allowed to become Tamei today. That's one potential argument. Granted, it's a little bit of a weak argument. A second argument would be, following Rav Unterman, that the bone material is not really dead, it's considered to have reintegrated in the body. Again, keeping in mind that it's not necessarily true that the bone is coming back to life in the way that a cornea comes back to life. Rav David Cohn, though, is quoted as supporting this argument, and he is a prominent authority. Number three, and this goes back to something that was suggested before, the form has changed. The form of the bone has changed. If you take a look on your sheets at, we're now turning to source number 29, he talks about a body that's been burned. This is the Rambam. He says, if a body is burned and its frame remains, it contaminates like a whole corpse. But if it's burned to the point that its form is confused, then it's actually considered to be pure. Here, acid burns the bone in the processing. Can I compare that to a burned body? And the answer is, Rabbi J. David Bleich and Rabbi Usher Weiss, both prominent legal authorities, support this. Rabbi Moshe Tendler and Rabbi David Feinstein oppose it. In terms of dealing with the contemporary authorities on this, and to give you some usable digest of it, if you take a look at the back sheet, you see that I gave you there a summary of the different mitigating factors that are brought on issues of impurity, and who agrees and who says, well, I'm not sure, or opposes. For those who sign in, and really everyone should, including those who came in later, because otherwise you won't get the credit for it. But I'm going to send out afterwards, anyway, added notes on this, and I will also send out the digital version of this so that anybody who didn't get the digital version in advance will have it, including this table. But that's a second argument, is that its form has changed. Another argument that's brought is that even if you say that burning it didn't take place, because it's only acid, maybe you could argue it has become like flour. It has lost the consistency of bone when it's ground up so finely. Source number 30, the Rambam talks about Bistara meis shenifrach, flesh of a corpse that crumbles. V'naaseh kekemach, it becomes like flour, so it is tahor, it is pure. V'chein efer asrufin tahor, also ash from a body that was burned. Now, the argument could be made, the consistency of graft material is not like flour. It's more coarse than flour. However, take a look at source number 31, Rabbi Yosef Karo, in his commentary on the Rambam. Rabbi Yosef Karo is the author of the Code of Jewish Law, and we take what he says very seriously as a matter of law. He says that it doesn't mean that it actually has crumbled, just that it's been dried out to such an extent that if you were to press it, it would crumble. That's already sufficient to render it flour-like, and therefore it will be considered pure. And Rav David Cohn accepts that argument. And again, that will remove my concerns. There's also an argument that's brought by Rabbi Usher Weiss, quoted in this Rabbi David Katz article, arguing that it's a brand new entity, as evidenced by the way the body accepts it. But I haven't found sources for that to support it. If anyone has to leave at this point, knowing that we had said originally that I would start at 8:45 and run for an hour, and we're now at the hour mark, please make sure you do get to sign in. If you could pass the sheets that they go to the back table, that way people can sign in back there and not I think that would be helpful. Thank you. So that's another set of arguments. These are all arguments to say, well, there's no impurity involved. The next argument is regarding Tumas Ohel. Let's say I don't accept the arguments that remove impurity as a concern, but I do accept I still want to deal with this material. So the argument could be made that Tumas Ohel, the Tumah of sharing a space, this contamination that comes from sharing space, may be the easiest to mitigate. Number one, if you go back to the table, you saw that the volume required in order to be liable for sharing a space is very large. Two handfuls, six eggs, I mean, it's a very large quantity. And therefore, the argument could be made that the oral surgeon simply shouldn't keep quantities like that in the office, and then he won't have an issue. Rav David Feinstein suggests it, Rav J. David Bleich suggests it. Further, the rules of impurity are very odd. I mean, the whole concept of impurity is an unusual one in and of itself. What does impurity mean? And that's definitely its own discussion. But they also differ between Jew and non-Jew. Jews and non-Jews will both contaminate in certain ways if they pass away. However, when it comes to tumas oel, tuma of being in shared space, that may not apply to bone coming from someone who wasn't Jewish. It may only apply to bone from a Jew due to technical reasons. The Shulchan Aruch does write, the Code of Jewish Law writes, I brought it in source 34, that one should in fact avoid it, a Kohen should avoid it, but there is room to argue that the tumah of shared space may not apply if you're dealing with someone who is not Jewish. So that may be a mitigating factor. What about tumah from, impurity from contact? So the barley kernel size is fairly small. That's a harder one to get around. If you could argue that crushed bone has a different status, then you've eliminated it altogether. Because if it's crushed bone, then you don't have the, if crushed bone is different, is unique, is not considered the same as regular bone, then indeed, tumas maga, tuma from contact, will not apply. Rav Moshe Feinstein, though, suggested that you handle it in a different way. His suggestion was twofold. Number one, he said, you can have that's on a separate point. His point for this is that we have a concept in Jewish law called tumah belua, impurity that's actually absorbed inside of a body. And if impurity is inside of a body and it's not going to shift around, then it's not going to communicate impurity on contact. It's absorbed inside. So therefore, he argues, as I brought in source 35, the doctors are not attaching this from the outside of the body. They're cutting the person open. He's not dealing with a dental bone graft. He's dealing with a graft in a leg. But the argument could be borrowed from there. The space is an internal site. I don't know. When you do a graft, is it under the gum line? It's under the gum line. Okay. So the argument could be made that therefore, once it's inside, it's no longer going to communicate impurity. That won't help the Kohen practitioner who's handling it, unless they're handling it entirely with gloves, and therefore they're not going to touch it. The argument could be made that the glove counts as an interruption, but because it's under the gum line, it won't contaminate the Kohen who is walking around with this inside the gum, and that could be grounds for leniency. When it comes to the tumah of transport of masa, what do I do with that type of impurity? So there, the recommendation is made, and I brought it in source 37 from Rav Moshe Feinstein regarding, he's dealing with a leg, where it's a lot easier to do this. His argument regarding a leg, putting bone in a leg is to immobilize the leg, and therefore he won't move until it's actually attached inside the body. That may work when you're dealing with the bone, with a bone in a leg. I'm not sure that that's going to work in terms of the person's mouth, that you could actually immobilize him so that he's not shifting around at all. I don't know. Is that? Right. No, but when you shift your head, you are moving whatever's there. That's the question. So that Rav Yisrael Belsky and Rav David Feinstein are quoted as saying this is what the Kohen practitioner should do. Number one, the quantity in the office is less than the quantity for communicating impurity in shared space. That's how you get around that one. But then have your assistant, who presumably is not a Kohen, bring it over to the patient so that the quantity is brought over without a problem. And then you, the Kohen practitioner, place it in small units less than the barley kernel. You're picking it up, putting it in, in order to avoid you actually transporting that quantity. That would be the a way of dealing with it. There's a little bit more to say about that, but I'm going to hold it with that. What you see, and if you look at the table then, you can see, and I really raced through this, I didn't quite do it justice. In general, I'm expecting that the classes will fit into the 45 minutes to an hour mold, but this topic is just the kind of topic that is too large. But what we already summed up what we said regarding the issue of benefit from a dead body and burial, that we took care of in the first summary. But this part, in terms of the impurity, number one, there is room to argue that general impurity would not be a concern. No one is willing to rely on the Ravid's view that a Kohen is allowed to become Tamei nowadays. No one that I saw on this was willing to accept that as a practical matter. But the argument of the bone returning to life, the argument that the material has been burned or is like flour at this point, the argument that these arguments are brought in favor of ignoring the impurity issue altogether and therefore saying the Kohen surgeon, the Kohen patient are all fine. In a case of need, I have to underline the issue of in a case of need. When we come back to in the second class, God willing, the issue of dental emergencies on Shabbos, we'll talk more about what qualifies as a case of need. The issues of for Tumas Ohel are mitigated by the fact that that's the shared space impurity, that you're using and you're keeping in your office less than a quantity that would communicate that kind of impurity. The issue of impurity being transmitted on contact is harder to work with unless we argue that it's viewed as pulverized bone or as rakav and therefore it will not communicate impurity on the same level, and that it's absorbed in the body so that once it's actually in below the gum line, there is no issue of contact with it anymore. And even the person who is a Kohen who has it carrying it around in his mouth is not guilty of, so to speak, being in contact with an impure item. And then last, the issue of carrying it. So you would mitigate that by having the assistant carry it over to the body and stabilizing the person. I wrote stabilize the leg because I was dealing with it in Ramosha's source. Stabilizing him so he's not going to shift until it's already inside. And then the last issue that I really didn't get to mention, but there is an important point as well in terms of this type of impurity. If it comes from multiple bodies, which generally speaking is true regarding bone banks, although according to the article that I keep citing, he said there is one bone bank he knows of that actually uses single donors for each batch. But if it's from multiple bodies, then it may not be considered to recombine in order to communicate impurity when it is transported. And therefore, that would serve as an additional mitigating factor. As you can see, and as I keep saying, there's much more to say on all of this, but working with the time frame that we have, that's what I